It seemed as if it was a fairly callous, I mean at the time, from the perspective that I had just arrived in the country. So, you know, from the perspective from where I was coming from, the people I was with, the people I was talking with, it appeared that it was a very callous propaganda stunt by the South Africans. As I say, within hours they'd launched attacks on a swapper basis in Angola. And then we're trying to shift the blame, you know, we're shifting the blame on SWAPO. Very quickly the South African propaganda machine was putting the blame on SWAPO.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously as time goes on and they produce this guy who claims to be a plan fighter, a SWAPO fighter, mm-hmm. in court a few months later you say, hang on, you know, but it's propaganda. As time goes on, you don't know. I mean, no, but that's where you...
Okay.
You know, Namibia in some respects needs a truth and reconciliation somehow to delve into these things. Who gave those orders? Who get this guy up and say, well, whose orders were you acting on? So, but today you don't know. We still don't know. But at the time, as I say, it seemed like a very callous, and the blame was put on the South Africans.
Did SWAPO do that kind of thing, though? I mean, could it be plausible that SWAPO would have done that? Did they blow up other kinds of things that had people, civilians in them?
The target, as the years went on, it seems that the differentiation between military targets and the soft targets and hard, whatever the term is,
mm-hmm.
military targets and civilian targets
mm-hmm.
became a bit blurred.
Okay.
Again, one theory is this guy was just acting on his own. And somehow it was a loose cannon. I don't know. Civilian targets were hit. I mean, in Windhoek, a car park in the center of town, a hotel car park got blown up. For some reason it was, I don't know, and SWAPO claimed responsibility.
Mm.
I don't know. I vaguely remember the justification being that it was a place where military people went. Perhaps, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Later that year, a hotel got blown up. Civilians got killed. It had no military significance whatsoever. But again, SWAPO denied they did it. By that stage, everything was so confused. But the perception was South Africans were blaming SWAPO. SWAPO denied they did it. And then the perception was largely, the majority, this was a very callous propaganda stunt,
mm-hmm.
and civilians got killed, and it certainly contributed to this chain reaction which followed, as I say, the student boycott, the nationwide boycott, and contributed to this whole heightened tension, this whole heightened sense of outrage and oppression at the South Africa, continued South African occupation.
Okay, now what I wanted to ask you was that there were a number of arms of the Southwest African security system. So you had the South African military forces, but you had also security forces, and then a special group called the Cobalt. So could you kind of describe how these different arms of the security would operate?
You had your conventional soldiers, your professional soldiers in the South African Defence Force. You also had a lot of conscripts from South Africa in the South African Defence Force.
Mm-hmm.
And now they were in Namibia primarily fighting in Angola. They were fighting the more conventional war in Angola and depending on what perspective you take, defending the borders, but also obviously fighting within Angola, fighting the sort of the combined forces. And that was, as I say, made up of conscripts and professional soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
You then had the Southwest African Territorial Force, which again was largely conscripts from Namibia. Again, led by, sort of run by a few professional soldiers.
Okay. Okay, so they were drafted into that.
They had to go. Yeah, and they are as within South Africa, you had compulsory conscription. So that was your sort of conventional fighting force, which was based all over the country, but concentrated within the north of the country. As I say, largely waging the war in Angola. Then you had your police unit called Kufut, which was a part of the police force. It was a counterinsurgency force. It was a paramilitary force. But they came under the police. And they were doing police operations, supposedly, but were basically were the front line of the fight against SWAPO guerrillas. Mm-hmm. So they were maintaining the law, doing police work, which was killing guerrillas. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, and they were set up early, late 70s, early 80s, as I say, as this paramilitary force. And because they weren't under your military command, they were under the police command, and they were fairly autonomous. I mean, they didn't really fall under your conventional police command. They were law unto themselves, and they had a very specific mission, which was to kill SWAPO guerrillas. And they went about that in their own way. They didn't have your conventional military discipline. They were all full-time people, paid. It was their job, was to go out and fight. Highly motivated people who, as I say, did not let a lot get in the way of their mission, which was to fight SWAPO on a guerrilla warfare basis.
Right. They have the reputation of being extraordinarily brutal. Did you ever come across any people who were in Kabul? Did you ever have a chance to interview or talk to them?
Yeah, working where we were working, we didn't, obviously, stayed well clear of them because we were perceived as part of the enemy in some respects. But occasionally you would meet these guys in bars and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly on a couple of occasions, I remember when we were working up there in the north, we'd bump into former Kufut people off duty, and so not revealing who we were, sort of get chatting with them. Very occasionally. Otherwise, it was in a very formal, if you were out reporting or whatever, and you would come across these people face to face, sort of they were doing their job on duty or whatever. But obviously it was at arm's length in those circumstances.
So I think you described to me an incident in the bar where you were talking and they were speaking somewhat about the training that they had gone through.
The bulk of Kufut were made up, or a lot of Kufut members were people from Ovamboland. Oshiwambo speakers, and who were recruited either just because it was a job, or because somehow maybe they were opposed to SWAPO, or else there were occasions where SWAPO captured SWAPO guerrillas, were then turned and made into, drafted into Kufut. We were in a bar with one off-duty Kufut guy and the local guy, he was sort of talking about how, when he'd been drafted into Kufut, he went through very rigorous, indoctrination.
Oh, okay.
As far as political indoctrination. As what the job was and what SWAPO was. And he actually said to us that after that, in that process, that indoctrination, that he'd been told his mother was a SWAPO, he would have killed her. It was heavy. It was
very heavy
psychological, whatever. And he showed. I mean, from their point of view, the Kufuts were at the very sharp end of the South Africans fighting in Swapo, and were, you know, really sort of vulnerable. I mean, particularly the Bashimanga speaking members of Kufut, not only were they fighting for a regime which was hated and detested by their own people, but they were doing it within their own communities, and they were often usually pitted against members of their own communities. So that sort of alienation was very, very strong, that sense of alienation. As I say, then you had very highly motivated South Africans, larger white South Africans running Kufut units, who were on a mission. I mean, it was, you know, they were there to save white civilization, Christianity, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, the Kufut units would pray every day before they went into battle. They would line up and pray. And, you know, so there was this really sort of strong motivation, strong psychological motivation towards a very brutal. I mean, yeah, you're out there in the bush and you're a target, and the Swapo guerrillas similarly were motivated. I mean, it was a really, this was where the battle was at most. Everybody was each other's, was prey. You were literally prey. So no, very little mercy was shown.
Right, I mean, they seem to have had a policy of basically shoot to kill, take no prisoners.
I mean, most of these incidences happened, you know, out the conflict where the shooting and the whatever took place. It was a battle situation, it was an ambush situation. Either Kufut were ambushing, got to know where guerrillas were and were attacking them, so it was defense attack, or else Kufuts were ambushed by Swapo guerrillas. Everybody was fighting for their lives. What the other approach was to track guerrillas, and that was largely what Kufut's prime aim was, to track down. And obviously it was in their interest in some respects to take prisoners in order to get information.
A lot of
captured clan fighters were then turned and made into fight for Kufut. So they didn't kill everybody, because it wasn't in their interest. It was just as much in their interest to capture some Swapo guerrillas. But whenever there was fighting, you know, it was you make sure you're the one who's going to get out alive, whichever side you're on. But Kufut's techniques for, as you sort of described earlier, getting information out of local people. Again, this was not a conventional war, this was guerrilla warfare. Therefore, every civilian you saw could be a Swapo guerrilla. And in that respect, the Kufuts were in uniform, at least. The Swapo guerrillas weren't necessarily in uniform. It was a guerrilla warfare. You had a very pro-Swapo community, population. And therefore, you know, to find out who was the guerrillas, and therefore who is your enemy, they employed pretty heavy-handed interrogation techniques to get their information. And as I say, when they were actually chasing Swapo guerrillas, very little got in their way.
Now, you had mentioned before that the tension was incredible, the stress, when you would go up to the north to try to cover a story. So what was the feeling of that?
I think it was the constant sense, of military, of war. The fact that it was a guerrilla war, therefore, at any moment, the road you were driving on could be landmines, could blow up. The bridge you were just about to drive over could blow up. The road you're driving on in the middle of the bush could be, maybe there's an ambush or you're just about to drive into a fight or something like that. Plus the curfew, the fact that you knew that if you were back out after dark, or even, as I say, that it was sunset to sunrise curfew. Now, depending on which time of the year and quite what weather was like, it depended when the sun went down. So
oh my God.
You could be out at, you know, and there was no, you know, sunrise and sunset does not happen at a certain time.
Yeah.
So it was open to interpretation.
And, yeah.
So you would be driving past military bases when the sun was going down, always thinking, well, now, am I out? Am I a target? So yeah, if you're having to live under that sort of circumstance, as I say, the constant threat that one of these, any moment, you might be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
Either as far as, you know, when suddenly security forces are chasing guerrillas, or guerrillas are looking for sanctuary or whatever, and you're just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and you get caught. This was constant. And you knew there was no recourse. I mean, it was no point saying, excuse me, I'm a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
Or, excuse me, what you're about, you're just about to shoot me, this is illegal.
Yeah,
you know, well, I want my lawyer, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Forget it, this is a war, this is a war zone.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was very, very constant tension. And all of that, of course, when you're living in that sort of environment, people are tense as well. And so the constant suspicion, who are you, what are you, where are you from, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So it all combined to this, as I say, this sort of incredibly tense atmosphere, environment, which the moment you drove out back into the south of the country, beyond the, out of the war zone, the official war zone,
mm-hmm.
it was like this huge weight would lift off your shoulders, because at least you were returning to a place where you knew roughly where you stood.
Yeah.
It would not so likely that the place was landmined. If you see soldiers, they're there on their way to somewhere, or they're part of, you know, you knew where you stood more.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk to you about the events surrounding April 1st. The UN operation was scheduled to begin on April 1st, 1989, and the special representative of the Secretary General, Martti Ahtisaari, arrived in Windhoek on that day. So, were you covering the events here in Windhoek at that time?
Yeah, I was in Windhoek at the time. The evening, the night before, was a night of massive celebration, certainly in Katatura. It was independence has come, it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Today is the day. And midnight, it was, you know, New Year's Eve 200 times over. People were out about, and then people just didn't sleep that night, and then the next morning there was a march, because again it was perceived that, hey, you know, freedom, we can go where we like, we do what we like, and this big march, the trade unions organized a big march. It was actually on some spurious political thing, or as far as no to denationalization, I think the interim government had planned to sell off state utilities or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a, but it was basically everybody saying, hey, independence has arrived, and big march started from Katatura into town.
Mm-hmm.
And it was stopped on the outskirts of town
mm-hmm.
by the police, who had their tear gas, and they just formed this cordon across the road
mm-hmm.
and said, you're not coming into town. So this suddenly, you can imagine this sort of, these people, they having not slept, having drunk a lot, and then this state of euphoria, saying, we're off into town where we've never been allowed to go before with our rallies and marches, because today independence starts.
Yeah.
Because the UN are arriving, and it's, today is April 1.
Oh.
And you were stopped in your tracks by who? The oppressor were there in front of you. And the march was turned back, and it was getting very ugly. And it didn't actually break into conflict, but you could see the frustration, and basically the South African, the police force saying, no, UN, things ain't changed that much.
Oh my God.
This is that your march is still against the law.
Yeah.
So that was sort of how the day began. Then, as I say, we went back to the office, and suddenly this report came through the telex. The wire service, that unidentified insurgents had have been intercepted. I've come across from Angola, been intercepted in the far north, and but heavy fighting had now broken out in the far north.
But now also, just to back up a little bit on that day, there was a demonstration, a rally at the airport. So who was that?
That was largely...
this was to meet Afisari again at the airport.
It was largely DTA people. Wow. It was the DTA being the opposition, or the main party within the interim government, the sort of the pro-South African semi-autonomous whatever regime. They'd rally. I mean, there was, yes, this basically the interim government parties shipped their supporters out to the airport to welcome Afisari.
Okay.
But along the roads was everything like, it was kind of as, I don't know, it was meant as obviously to create an impression that, you know, it's, hey, you people have been dealing with SWAPO all this time, but we're here. This is, you know, and we've got big support. And all along the road was actually painted, Viva DTA, had slogans all the way along the road, painted on the road itself.
On the tar
on the road. So you would have had to drive, you did drive over these slogans. All along the road with DTA. This is a 40-kilometer stretch.
Yeah, it's a long road.
From the airport into town.
Yeah.
So about every 2 or 3, 4 kilometers there was one of these slogans on the road. And then there was DTA posters, DTA and whatever. And then a lot of DTA supporters, plus these other interim government parties, gathered at the airport. Yeah, to greet, you know, to welcome him, but to say, hey, you know, we're here as well. It's not just SWAPO you're dealing with.
Yeah, yeah.
So
and then SWAPO was kept from going there.
Well, there was nothing stopping them from going there, but I don't think, you know, were they stopped from going there? I don't know. I don't think they were stopped from going there, but it was not, what was the point? The point was, no, people were busy celebrating in town. Okay. No, it wasn't, no, the march from Katatura was not...
To the airport, it was to the center of
Windsor. It was the center of town, yeah. Oh, so it was different strategies. The DTA said, let's get out to the airport. They had the resources to get people out to the airport.
Because it was so far, no, we could walk all that way.
No, you had trains. I mean, trains taking, you even had like, you had your Ovahimba, which are your sort of very traditional, what is it, your, how do you describe, what's the proper word for describing Ovahimba? People from the very far north, very migrant, subsistence, traditional people who still wandered around bare-breasted and in loincloth sort of thing, brought down and were there, camped outside the airport. Had been brought on trains, all the people had been shipped there, and it was a massive operation. Huge resources.
But all done by DTA.
DTA and the interim government parties, yeah, to create this impression for Afisari on his arrival.
Oh my God.
So, yeah, that was a very big. So, that was his first impression of Namibia. This DTA massive, people there waving flags and welcome, whatever. But it was, you know, and as I say, it was DTA.
Oh my God.
So, and as I say, meanwhile in town, so this big rally was stopped on the outskirts of town.
So he couldn't see that?
Didn't see that, no.
Yeah. So then he went to the hotel, and then he received this information that SWAPO forces had come over the border. So, where was that information coming from? Who had access to that information?
As far as he was concerned, I don't know. We got it through the wire services. Largely we're reliant on the wire services. Because
and who controlled the wire services?
The main wire service was South African Press Agency, which was not a government-controlled news agency, but it was controlled, owned by most of the newspaper groups, most of which were pro-establishment, pro-minority rule, at least, you know, I mean, it was business interests, sort of conservative business interests, which ran the media and therefore owned this agency. But it was, you know, it was not state propaganda. So it was, journalists, correspondents, their correspondents in the north filing stories saying, hey, what's going on here? So yeah, it was, it was not South African propaganda, it was true facts. I mean, in that respect, and this was all we had to go on as journalists at the time.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't have any other independent source of information?
Well, as soon as this information started coming through, we tried to phone people in the north, but got this very confused. Obviously, no one knew what was going on. Nobody knew what was going on.
Okay.
So for the first couple of days, day or so, it was a sort of, it was, well, this is what the wire agencies are saying, this is what UN says, this is what South Africans say. And then we got people, then Chris went up pretty soon after the first reports came through, probably the next day.
Okay.
So he went up for a few days and then came back with his reports and interviewing with eyewitnesses and whatever. Mm-hmm. So it was a fairly slow process.
When you were, or Chris would go up, again, how did you get access to the information? I mean, I think you had mentioned to me that that it was really the South African military that would have to take you to where we were going.
Well, not us, because we knew where we were going. I think what you had, I mean, along with Arthur Sarrow's arrival, you had, of course, your international press contingent, media corps, who arrived basically to record a few press conferences, a few handshakes, a few colour pieces on this is Namibia, about on the dawn of its liberation, its independence, a new country, the process is about to start. And all of a sudden, war breaks out, 700 kilometres to the north, 800 kilometres to the north, in a place where, nobody knew. So your actual press corps, suddenly you got your editors and wherever, Europe and North America saying, hey, get up there, get the story.
Okay.
So yeah, those people, very few of them would have known what the hell was going on. The only place to stay was in Oshakati in the military garrison. You go up there, you need pictures, you need story.
Yeah.
Who's going to provide that? Of course, the South African military.
Okay,
So as our rule, your international press corps was fairly reliant on the South Africans as sources of information because there was no other sources of information.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't necessarily know the place, they couldn't obviously speak Oshawambo. So, and they had deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the Namibian and the local media knew the area.
Yeah.
Had his contacts, knew what he was doing, had people who spoke the language. So we went up and out of principle, didn't get information. I mean, you got your information, South African side of the story from Bintu.
Yeah.
So we actually went up there and went to scenes of fighting, interviewed villagers, went to see the bodies and whatever, and tried to put together what had happened through these sort of eyewitness interviews. So that was, that was how we went about it, and that was where we were getting our information from.
Okay, so what kind of information did you get? Was the fighting happening in various different places, or was there some centralization to it? Or?
What was obviously happening was that you had these groups of SWAPO fighters coming across, walking, so villagers were telling us to give themselves up to the UN to form bases in Namibia, but they were moving as groups of probably around 10 to 20, which was not usual.
Yeah, and were they just open, out in the open, walking?
They were, certainly initially, they were making, it was not, they weren't, obviously the fact that, the way that they were then attacked, they were in a group, they weren't open, out in the open, but at the same time, some villagers would describe how they came singing. They were singing liberation songs as they made their way through the bush. So it was obviously, it was not an undercover operation, but at the same time you were moving through the countryside, through village, dense bush, and they were armed, and they were moving into the war zone. So you sense, as I say, putting together the eyewitness accounts, the sense that these gorillas, they were at the same time probably wary, but were not necessary. They were not fully alert. I mean, they were not. They obviously initially believed that the ceasefire was holding, and they were not going to be attacked. But they were.
And then, but they were attacked.
And then word soon spread that they. And obviously, then when they were attacked, then fighting started, and then people just spread.
So, when they were attacked, what? Who was attacking them? Was it Kofa? Was it security?
It was, initially it was Kufud for the first week. It was Kufud because Kufud were police. Therefore, at that stage, South African forces, SADF, and the SWATIF, the Southwest African Territory Force, the conventional armies, had been confined to base.
Okay, so those groups had been confined to base, but the police and Kufud, as
police,
part of the police, were not
police,
confined.
Yeah, Kufud were part of the police force, therefore were not confined to base. And this issue was a contentious issue right up until about 2 weeks before the elections, which was November. It was not resolved, and it was a constant battle for the UN. It was one of the main areas of contention. The UN said Kufud is military, therefore must be confined to base, dearmed, demobilized. South Africans said, no, Kufud are police, therefore we won't have their carrying on. And as I say, it went on. But they were the, basically the people who then fought, and who got obviously heard that the guerrillas were coming across and attacked. They said this is an invasion. Mm-hmm. These people are entering the country illegally. Mm-hmm. They are SWAPO. They are armed, and they went in.
Okay. So when the news was coming in that there was fighting in the north, it was between SWAPO and Kofut. Because
the
Kofut hadn't been confined to bed.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess what I wanted to ask you, because now we're getting close to the end. when voter registration began, to take place, and there was an attempt to develop a code of conduct. Perez de Cuellar had come to Windhoek and had brought the parties together to develop some kind of sense of cooperation. What was the reaction? How did the media respond to that, or how was that covered?
I think depended on the media. When the UN arrived, it had very little in place, certainly as far as information dissemination, media strategy, it was starting from scratch.
Okay.
Now obviously you arrive and war breaks out. And right from the start, therefore, they were facing a lot of media hostility. They were on the defensive. They had no time to make any kind of contacts with the local media. Didn't know anybody. Nobody knew them. And all of a sudden, you've got this major PR job on your hands. Mm-hmm. Sort of trying to explain what was going on.
Yeah. Okay.
So the relationship between the media, all the media. I mean, from the Namibian side, from the Namibian, it was obviously hostility at the respect of what the hell's going on here. I mean, channeling that sort of sense of disbelief, despondency, outrage from the readership, the majority of the people, was what the hell is going on here? You're supposed to be bringing peace, and you war's broken out. From the sort of pro-South African, pro-DTA camp, the media was hostile because UNTAG was coming to sell the country down the river to the communists.
Mm-hmm.
So, they were caught. Immediately, UN was caught between the media. Now, as time went on, they gradually had to obviously got their PR, their information, whatever operation in place. Started using the media, but largely use the media which they could at least have some influence over, which was the broadcaster.
The radio.
Yeah. Southwest Avenue Broadcasting Corporation, which it had some, whatever, because it was a state organ, it had some inroad, you know, it could get into it because it was part of, you know, through the South African regime. Mm-hmm. Obviously, radio was the main way of reaching people as well, so it was vital, it was strategically important, but it was also the medium over which at least the UN could have some influence. Mm-hmm. Although it was again a pretty hostile love-hate relationship, because it was also the pro-South African, it was the South African mouthpiece it was as well,
yeah.
So it was a similar relationship with the SWAPC, which the UN had, as it did with the police force, as it did with the army, as it did with the South African authorities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this sort of, well, we've got to work together, but mm-hmm. oh, we hate your guts.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, maybe that's a bit of a simplification. But whereas the private media, as I say, was, which was largely the newspapers,
mm-hmm.
was this, was never, yeah, time went on, obviously, the UN tried to, the UN Information Department, Fred Eckhart and people like did a lot of work to try and establish relationships with it.
Okay.
And gradually, you know, it did. And but there was still, from as far as coverage was concerned, you know, it was basically, well, we try to get, try and get cooperation. UN was trying to get cooperation, but obviously couldn't count on it because mm-hmm. they were, you know, it was private media. It was, so it was not the focus, main focus of their information, apart from obviously placing adverts and things like that. So yeah, when it actually came to sort of things like election codes and things like that, the media was always asking questions. It was criticizing, analyzing, asking questions about these things, voicing, probably, you know, obviously depending on the constituency, concerns about these things. So yeah, the election code, there was obviously some people were unhappy with it. It was a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Would it work? You know, everyone was still very skeptical. I mean, this sort of skepticism remained. It took a lot of obviously it took a lot on doing. It remained right up until the elections, based largely, I think, on the experiences of April 1 and those first few days of the independence process.
Yeah. So that whole event really soured.
Oh yeah,
the whole.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a miracle that it's a miracle they managed to salvage something out of it.
Yeah,
and that by the end it could at least, that it got an election off the ground and going. And
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
two weeks before the elections, there was still, particularly up in the far north, there was violence. There was, there was no way that people were saying, well, hell, are these elections going to go ahead?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were ready to call it off. The UN was ready to call it off right up until the final day.
Oh my God.
It was that hit and miss, that sort of touch and go, as far as whether, you know, because they had to create an environment which was where free and fair elections would take place.
Yeah.
And certainly, and I think that was where the media was important, in that, you know, well, or was always questioning, was, well, is this environment free and fair? You know,
yeah.
You know, as I say, right up until 2 weeks before, Kufuor was not demobilized.
Yeah.
Is this free and fair?
Yeah.
Can you really have a fair election when you've got police, you know, the main sort of SWAPO battering ram, armed and wandering around and
intimidating. Yeah, yeah.
From the point of view of, from the other side, I mean, you know, can you have free and fair elections when, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example, but where, you know, I mean, obviously, I think that the main thrust of the pro-South Africans' complaint, will these elections be free and fair, was that, well, the UN is biased anyway, and it was constantly looking to discredit the UN, and that SWAPO wasn't playing by the rules. So this was the kind of, you know, everyone was trying to justify a point, and to, yeah, in the middle was the UN trying to sort of lay down trying to make a situation where it was free and fair, where it could go ahead, because obviously that was their mission.
Mm-hmm.
But they're being sort of barraged left, right, and centre, being told, well, it's not free and fair.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you, because I was reading just briefly about some things that eventually happened with this, the Southwest African Broadcasting Corporation, because right around the time of the elections, the control of the Broadcasting Corporation sort of began to disintegrate. Were you aware of any of that, or what was going on with the radio?
What, from the UN point of view? They felt that it was disintegrating.
No, I was just reading something that NDI had mm-hmm. put out, a report that a lot of the board of the SWABC resigned.
Okay. Did they resign?
Right before the elections.
Stands out, it wasn't necessarily the resignation. They were replaced, weren't they? I think what had happened was that basically the credibility of the SWABC. The SWABC was important as far as voter education, vital.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was the problem the UN was faced with, that it was having to work through the SWABC. Mm. But the SWABC was totally biased. Mm-hmm. And this was established. I mean, a group did research on SWABC news coverage. Mm-hmm. And found consistently that it was biased. It was pro-South African. Mm-hmm. I mean, for various reasons, not all of it necessary propaganda. There was incompetency in as far as not being able to analyze, which is a problem which exists today in the media.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically news coverage, programming was biased in favor of South African and the DTA and against SWAPO. And this was again a constant battling point for the UN, because obviously the pressure was from SWAPO to say, look, this is unfair, this is not a free, conducive to free and fair elections. You've got propaganda, you've got a biased broadcaster, which the UN was having to work with as his main conduit for information.
Okay. So the UN did not have its own broadcasting system.
It
had to work through
SWABC.
Okay.
So I think what happened eventually, again, it was a compromise that all the parties formed, there was an advisory committee force which the SWABC then had to relate to.
Okay.
And now I don't know, as I said, I don't recall the SWABC board members, but they weren't sort of people you socialized with or sort of took much notice of anyway.
Right.
They might have, I think maybe they did, were forced to resign and they were replaced by this sort of committee, which, as I say, the SWABC then had to work with, and this committee was made up of all the parties, because it was largely around the issue of election coverage now, campaign coverage, and flighting.
So it was important that happened prior to the elections, because it seemed to have happened like just a week or so.
Yeah, before. It was again. It was very last minute. And came after months and months of wrangling.
Yeah.
Of people saying SWABC is biased, it's not doing its job, it's not impartial. And somehow the South African authorities saying no, it is all right, it's not the least, not wanting to relinquish, making sure it was not going to relinquish it, control of SWABC for as long as possible.
Yeah, okay.
Because it was
almost at the end of the tape. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm going to just stop it and start like a few minutes in the next tape, if that's okay with you. Okay, well, there's a few more minutes on the tape, but if we carry on, I have another tape. Because I wanted to ask you, as the election results were coming in, in the first days, the election took place over about a four-day period, something like that, and then the first election results were coming in. And I understand that the first results were those coming in from the way south of Namibia, southern part of Namibia, and that those results actually favored DTA.
Yeah.
Yeah? So how was that evolving? Why?
It created, the impression it created was that DTA was going to win the election. And this was, because no one had really analyzed, no one knew, I mean, the fact that the voting happened. I mean, no one actually thought about counting the results or whatever, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, and you're thinking what's happening next. Mm-hmm. So once the voting had happened, so I mean, from a news coverage point of view,
mm-hmm.
the voting happened, fine. So all the reports was about the voting, whether there'd been intimidation, what had happened, all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden says, ah, yeah, now the results are going to start coming out.
Right.
Okay, well, what does this mean? Well, yeah, results are going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And no one had sort of thought, as far as numbers and where the big constituencies were and how significant this was or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So you turn on the radio and says, oh, the first results are due. And so somebody said, oh, I'll turn on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So the results started coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had basically these results being announced over the radio, in between just music being played.
Mm-hmm.
And they were announced by this sort of Morse code, beep, 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 beep. And that was to announce, to tell you that a result was coming through.
Okay, okay.
So gradually, very quickly, this sort of pattern was established, you know, people clicked on.
Yeah.
You tune into your radio, you get the results. And whenever there was this Morse code, everybody stopped and gathered around the radio. And this was happening everywhere. This was now, the country was now, suddenly you realize, oh, here come the results, and now the country is gripped.
Yeah.
So the results started coming in, and as I say, it was more, people didn't think necessarily in terms of figures, but who had won. For every country,